If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
One of the worst sports days in recent memory. Two, let's look into our crystal ball and find out what's next for the Supreme Court with Fox News legal analyst and law professor Jonathan Turley. Three, my five worst sports moments as a fan. It's the Will Cain Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? Welcome to Friday. As always, I hope you will download, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your audio entertainment. Apple, Spotify, YouTube, Rumble, or Fox News Podcasts. I'm getting too old for this. I am too old for this. I know that. I know I shouldn't allow my emotions to be controlled by strangers far away, in some cases, far off away in Europe, and allow my day to be ruined by something that cares nothing for me. Sports doesn't care about me. Why do I care about sports? Yesterday was a very bad day for me as a sports fan. It was like walking through a gauntlet of baseball bats with my emotions worn on the outside, taken lick after lick. By the end of the day, I had a headache. I was emotionally exhausted, and I just wanted to go to bed. And I understand it's also immature. I understand it allows me to be wide open for mockery. And I don't care. I'm going to saddle back up and do it once again. Today, I'll explain to you exactly why yesterday was so bad. I'm also going to share with you my five worst moments as a sports fan. And we have a deep dive conversation with law professor Jonathan Turley. Jonathan Turley is a Fox News legal analyst. He's the Shapiro Chair of Public Interest at George Washington University. And he is someone that we hope to shine up, glare into the crystal ball of the future on what's next for Roe v. Wade, but perhaps more importantly, what's next for the Supreme Court of the United States. And we have a fascinating tangential conversation about whether or not John Paul MacIsaac, the computer shop repairman who found Hunter Biden's laptop, can sue the pants off the Daily Beast, Politico, and CNN. Stay tuned for that conversation in just a moment here on the Will Cain Podcast. But first, number one. Yesterday, I took two big sports L's in consecutive fashion, but they were two very different types of losses. Late last night, I stayed up way past my bedtime to watch the Dallas Mavericks completely dismantled by the Phoenix Suns. By the time you're listening to this podcast, Friday night will be game three of the Western Conference semifinals between the Phoenix Suns and the Dallas Mavericks. We're returning to Dallas, and hopefully being at home will unleash Luka magic. Luka just doesn't have much support. Whatever the magic was for Jalen Brunson against the Utah Jazz seems to have magically disappeared against the Phoenix Suns. But truth be told, Phoenix is the better team. Phoenix is really good. Phoenix had an effective shooting percentage of 75%. I know many of you listening don't care so much about sports. Stick with me for a moment, because maybe this is a conversation about maturity. Maybe this is a conversation about emotional investment. But I just want to say for the record that I think Luka has to find another level. He's incredible, and he's a top five player in the NBA. But as Stephen A. Smith famously says, there are levels to this. There is still yet another level that needs to be reached by Luka Doncic, specifically defensively, before he is a world champion. For now, one of my favorite characters in the NBA, Monty Williams, the head coach of the Phoenix Suns, seems to have the best team in the NBA. But that loss wasn't so hard for me to take because the Mavericks, by the time the fourth quarter came around, were dominated by the Phoenix Suns. Rather, the bigger gut punch was what happened midday in the middle of the week in a sport that I would imagine many of you could absolutely not spare a single care. It was the Champions League of European soccer. Now, let's just take a moment and talk about soccer. Look, my sports credibility is unimpeachable. What I mean by that is I understand the brand of soccer. I can see others who dabble in sports talk about soccer as a communist sport. And then it's bad for my brand to talk about soccer as a red-blooded American. I don't care. I love me some soccer. Love it. Love it. Might be number two behind football. I love watching it. I love the geometry. I love learning about it. I love actually seeing the tactics play out versus what, from an untrained eye, looks like just somewhat controlled chaos. Boot the ball forward and hope that it breaks the right way for somebody to score. I love the mind game of soccer. I've also enjoyed the process of learning about various teams across the globe and their history and their fan bases. And that brings me to the team that I root for. I root for Manchester City. Now, again, for many out there, oh, Will picked the best team money can buy, owned by Arab Oil. Will's a glory hound. He just wants championships. To that, I would say, hey, how many championships in Europe has Manchester City earned? No, Manchester City's earned heartbreak. And I know championships in the Premier League. But here's the thing. Here's why I like Manchester City. And let me back into why I like soccer again. Finding a soccer team was my first opportunity to be a sports free agent. I've explained to you in the past that I believe rooting for a sports team is like a birthright. You are largely bequeathed your fandom if it's done appropriately. You are an inheritee of your sports team based upon whatever geographic location you were born. I was born in Sherman, Texas, 1 hour away from Dallas. So my teams are the Dallas Cowboys, the Dallas Mavericks, the Texas Rangers, and the Dallas Stars. I didn't choose those teams. Those teams were given to me. There is, in my estimation, one asterisk on this inheritance. There's one exception, one caveat, one parenthetical, and that is if you have one of your parents who brainwashes you from childhood. And this will back me into why I love soccer. All of it is about your relationship with your dad or your best friend, or now your sons or your children or your daughter. If your dad brainwashed you into being a fan of a team where you were not born because he has some geographic connection, then you are sufficiently brainwashed. You are sufficiently inducted. Both of my sons were born in New York City, and as far as they are concerned, the Dallas Mavericks and the Dallas Cowboys are New York's teams. We now live in Dallas, and they have a geographic right to their fandom, but for the first decade plus of their lives, they were fans by brainwashing. And that brings me back to why I love soccer. I used to mock this sport, any sport that could end in a 0-0 tie. I, too, would call it communist until my son started playing it and we started connecting. I wanted to learn everything about the sport so I understood what they were doing and how they could get better. And then I wanted to wake up on Saturday and Sunday mornings and watch soccer with them. I picked Manchester City not because I was a glory hound, but because we as a family started rooting for NYCFC. Soccer being the only sport I got to be a free agent in, my exception to the brainwashing or the geographic inheritance. I didn't grow up with a professional soccer team, so I got to shop. And NYCFC is half owned by Manchester City. I was going to pick a team in the English Premier League, and then I needed to pick a team in the top six. I will admit here, I wanted a team that was at least in competition to win the Premier League and to play in Europe in the Champions League. That gave me about six teams to pick from. I like powder blue. And then I fell in love with what I think is one of the most amazing athletes I've ever watched in my life, and his name is Kevin De Bruyne. All of it added up to we as a family choosing Manchester City. Yesterday, Manchester City choked in an all-time fashion. It inspired me to put together a list of top five sports losses in my career as a fan. It was absolutely unfathomable, unbelievable. How did Manchester City get bounced once again from the Champions League? Here's the story. It's the semifinals. In European soccer, you play two legs, two games, one at home and one away. You have to win on aggregate goals, meaning Manchester City won the first game 4-3 over Real Madrid, the royalty of Spain. But everyone knew it was a bad news game. You won 4-3, but you left so many goals, hitting the post, just missing, out on the field. And it was a bad omen. Manchester City were the better squad than Real Madrid, but yet you knew the door is left open, the door is cracked. But in the second game, in the second leg against Real in Madrid, Manchester City was once again winning 1-0. On aggregate, the score is 5-3 now. Two-goal advantage to advance to the finals. There's a 90-minute clock in soccer, and then it's over, plus a little stoppage time, so it adds up to about 93 minutes. It's the 89th minute, and Manchester City is up by two goals. Now listen, in soccer, that's like being up 28-3 like the Atlanta Falcons and New England Patriots, but in the final 2 minutes, it is unfathomable that you would choke up this kind of lead. And yet, they did. And yet, did City. Real Madrid scored two goals in 1 minute to tie the game. Now the series is tied on aggregate, 5-5, and we're headed for overtime, extra time. And there you get a fluky call of a penalty. Real Madrid scores the penalty shot, and it's over. Three goals in a blink of an eye. And once again, year after year, in heartbreaking fashion, Manchester City cannot win it all in Europe. They're generally considered perhaps the best team in the world, with the talent on the field and the manager who's considered the best manager in the world, and yet they choke. Maybe it's karma for all of you that say, oh, they buy the best players. But you can't also say they're glory hounds. It was gut-wrenching to lose like that, and that type of loss hurts way more than getting dominated by the Phoenix Suns. Not because I care more about City than the Mavericks, but again, to invoke Stephen A. Smith, when it comes to losses, there are levels to this. I'll explain ahead in my top five losses as a sports fan of all time.
We'll be right back with more of the Will Cain podcast.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Story number two. Jonathan Turley is a Fox News legal analyst. He is the Shapiro Chair of Public Interest Law at George Washington University. He is a former criminal defense attorney. He is familiar with the Supreme Court. He has watched and covered it for years. In the last episode of the Will Cain podcast, we did a deep dive on the tactics, on the fallout of the law, on the morality of abortion. Today, we wanted to look forward with a crystal ball and have this conversation with Jonathan Turley. Jonathan, I'm so glad to have you with me today. On a previous episode of the Will Cain podcast, I broke down with Shannon Bream, Andy McCarthy, and Ben Domenech the suspicions around who the leaker may be, the potential charges that could be brought against the leaker, and the morality of the entire issue. And I would encourage anyone listening to go back and listen to that episode, because what I want to do with you today is I want to look forward. I want to use you as our crystal ball, Jonathan, and I want to start asking questions about what happens next. So let's start with this. Do you think the person that leaked this draft memo from the Supreme Court will be caught?
Yes, I do. It's hard to tell how clever this person may be. This was an incredibly reckless decision. It might have been done in an equally reckless way. We're assuming that someone who's working in the court is smart enough to cover their tracks, but it's not as easy as people think. The Supreme Court has internal procedures designed to restrict the number of drafts, limit electronic devices. There's a lot of surveillance within the court. I do believe the person will be eventually discovered.
Do you think there will be any form of accountability, any form of punishment? You and I have had a relationship through the airways at Fox. We've talked about a multitude of different issues, and we could right now talk about the potential for accountability when it comes to Hunter Biden and so many other different governmental political scandals that never seem to come to a moment of accountability, Jonathan. Do you think once this person is ascertained, there will be any form of punishment?
I do. This, to me, seems a rather obvious disbarment qualification. I can't imagine that this person could practice law after violating the most basic ethical and professional standards that they assumed. We don't know if it's an individual or individuals. We assume it's one. But I would expect disbarment at the least. In terms of consequences, there's also a chance for possible criminal charges. I've been a little bit skeptical about stretching the definition of theft or obstruction. I think that's probably going to be difficult. I think it's more likely, if there was a prosecution, to prosecute for false statements given to federal investigators. Whoever this person is, likely faced a rather chilling moment in short order. There's a small number of people that have access to this stuff. And the person's probably already been approached, as with other people, by investigators. If you lie to investigators, that's a crime, and people are prosecuted routinely in Washington for that crime under 18 U.S.C. 1001.
So we had a conversation with former federal prosecutor Andy McCarthy, and he laid out three potential criminal charges, and you mentioned two of them. One, obstruction of justice. Two, embezzlement or theft. Three, conspiracy to defraud the federal government. And you're telling me you also would add a fourth. While you were somewhat skeptical about those three potential charges, it's that if they already lied to the FBI in the midst of an investigation, it's probable the investigation has already taken in the 36 clerks, the 9 justices, and probably the support staff. And if we haven't yet found the name or had an arrest, that means a probability that somebody has already lied, adding, in your mind, the most likely potential charge.
I think that's right. I would be surprised to see them stretch the criminal code on issues like embezzlement or theft or obstruction. These would be difficult cases to bring because it deals with scienter or intent. What was the motivation? I'm still a little bit skeptical that this person thought that they would influence the justices themselves. You would have to be really moronic, because it's more likely that the justices would dig in further rather than change their vote when faced with this type of act. It seemed to be more likely directed to the outside to trigger a political backlash, maybe influence Congress to act. And that makes those types of cases a little tougher on things like obstruction. But these are all possible charges. The other question is what the appetite for the court is for a prosecution. If I were the Chief Justice, I would have a considerable appetite for any and all types of punishment.
So let's talk about that then. You're a longtime watcher. You're a legal analyst. You're a longtime watcher of the Supreme Court. What's the fallout behind the scenes, Jonathan? I mean, a very significant breach of trust has been committed. And these justices have to operate in a world where, yes, they disagree deeply on their views of the Constitution, but there's, at least historically, a ton of collegiality. I mean, the notorious or the most famous example of that is Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice Antonin Scalia. Now, today, I would have to think all nine justices, and then add in the 36 clerks on top of that, are looking side-eye at each other every day. What's that mean for the future of the court?
Well, it's sort of funny, Will, because you're right. I've covered the court for a long time. I teach a course on the Supreme Court. But I was shocked by the leak. And it's an odd thing that I was shocked. I've been in this town a long time. This town tends to make you sort of cynical. And it floats on a sea of leaks. But most of us never thought this day would come, because the attachment, the identification, the connection to the court by justices and clerks are so strong. No one thought that anyone would break that. And there's a sense of a type of loss of innocence, you know, that there are security procedures in the court, but the primary protection was this institutional bond. I mean, the fact is that no matter what you do, you can't protect against someone who's willing to take a breathtakingly unethical act. Humans right. have to be involved here. This is a collaborative process. They go through a lot of drafts. So you can't turn this into a national security skiff, you know, where, you know, people have to go into a protected room. That's just not how they work. The Supreme Court has a sort of almost monastic feel to it. It's closed off. It's insular. It's very personal and intimate. That has been shattered. And I'm not too sure how they will recover as an institution completely after this.
Well, let's talk about what the practical effects of that shattering of trust might be. As you point out, and I've seen you already commenting on this on various social media platforms, you don't think the leaker was actually trying to influence the court, but rather affect some type of political reaction, meaning Congress pass a law to formally institute a right to privacy or a right to an abortion, or midterm election wins, some type of political outcome. But there is already taking place an either advertent or inadvertent influence on the court. You've talked about this group out there. I think it's something to do with "We're Sent by Ruth" or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's the name of the group. And they're threatening justices. They are doxing justices. They're looking to end up at the homes of justices. And this is why I bring this up. And we're going to play in the realm of speculation and hypothetical here for just a moment. I don't think it's reckless, but I think it's more valuable as a hypothetical. Let's say it's a clerk. Let's say it's a clerk for Justice Sotomayor. What happens to the relationship between Justice Sotomayor and the rest of her colleagues after they've been the subject of threats?
Well, it's a good question. You know, Sotomayor caused something of a stir when in the oral arguments of this very case, she said that there was a stench of politics in the case and was referring to her three newest colleagues, suggesting they were put on the court to reverse Roe. Some of us called her out on that as a violation of the decorum of the court. It was also grossly unfair, in my view, due to make that statement. If, in fact, the clerk came from her chambers, that stench comment would be particularly odious. But the campaign to go to the homes of justices, I think you're right, Will, to raise, because what's the point, right? That's clearly not trying to get the justices to change their minds. These justices aren't going to say, oh, my God, just stay away from my home. I will suddenly say Roe is constitutional. It's the sad thing about it is that it's really just sort of an addiction to rage. We've become a country addicted to rage, and people just want to go to the homes of these people. And the question is, could this person, if it was a clerk, have the same addiction? You know, I've been complaining for many years on campuses that we've been training students to be rageful, to not tolerate opposing positions, to disrespect institutions and values. This isn't the ultimate example of that, that there's no institution or value that's considered inviolate anymore, to the point that people go to the homes of justices to try to harass and intimidate the people inside.
Yeah, Jonathan, I've seen that in the last couple of days. I've seen that some law professors, for example, it was an anonymous professor from Yale reportedly who said, doesn't surprise me at all. We have been graduating people who see themselves as advocates. So there is no tactic that would be beneath them in accomplishing their goal, which is, look, you're a law professor. I went to law school. I loved law school, Jonathan. I loved it. I went to law school in Austin, Texas, so there was a lot to love about that 3-year experience. But I loved literally the process of learning about processes, about the Constitution, about the way to think, not what to think, but the way to arrive at a conclusion, not handing me a conclusion. And so I think a lot of professors today are saying what you're saying. I'm not surprised.
Unfortunately, that is very much the case. That is, we're raising a generation of censors, of people who are taught that opposing views are harmful and unsafe, and that they have a right to silence others. You see that today with Twitter, you know, with Musk taking over Twitter. What was the first response of people like Hillary Clinton? They went to Europe right. and said, you should censor Twitter. There's this sense that it's by any means necessary. And that's a direct quote, by the way, from Democratic operatives just a few weeks ago, saying that they wanted to win by any means necessary. And there was a time when that was considered a shameful statement. And it was a time when lawyers would never utter such a statement. Mm-hmm. But we live in different times now.
I want to come back to the crystal ball in just one moment. But while we're on this sort of tangent on free speech, Elon Musk, Twitter, I wanted to ask you about one of the things that sort of hit my radar. I saw in the news, Jonathan, that the laptop repair shop owner, John Paul MacIsaac, who brought the Hunter Biden laptop to the forefront of the news cycle, has filed a defamation. I believe it's a defamation lawsuit against CNN, The Daily Beast, Politico, and a few other organizations, saying they defamed his character by suggesting he was a Russian asset, that he was distributing Russian disinformation. We saw a successful, we think it's successful, defamation lawsuit by the Covington Catholic kids. We think because it was a settlement. We're seeing that Kyle Rittenhouse is looking at a defamation lawsuit. I'm just curious, when you look at these, and let's focus most specifically on John Paul MacIsaac, is it likely? I mean, I don't want to say, is it likely you effectuate a settlement? Because settlements are tough. It means, you know, settlements aren't an admission of guilt. They are a cost-benefit analysis for most of the parties involved. But when you look at guys like Rittenhouse or MacIsaac, do you have a likely chance of victory on a defamation suit against a mainstream media organization that does this? Because they're doing this all the time, Jonathan.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it likely. I wish him the best of luck. And actually, I do believe that Sandman's lawsuits against the media was more than warranted. Mm-hmm. And the expectation is he did get damages in those cases, at least settlement payments. I think it'll be tough. I think that the court will very likely treat him as a public figure, which imposes a higher standard upon him, a public figure because they will argue that he did speak to the media and triggered that category. The court will have to decide whether he's a public figure or a limited public figure. If they do, then he has to satisfy a much higher standard.
Right.
Against the media companies, it's hard because they were speculating based on the news. With someone like right. Schiff and others, where they were more specific, he's got a better shot. You know, it's one thing to speculate that maybe this computer found its way through Russian intelligence to this shop. It's quite another to say that this shop was responsible for Russian disinformation.
Wouldn't Schiff, as a politician, have some type of prosecutorial immunity? Wouldn't he have some kind of governmental immunity?
His legislative immunity under the speech and debates clause, but that's limited. Once you're off the floor or you're not in committee, you lose it. And you know, I represented Eric Fordish, who was involved in one of the most important of these cases, Fordish against ABC. That was the Elizabeth Morgan case. I wasn't his counsel during that case. I was counsel when we struck down the so-called Elizabeth Morgan law. But when they tried to pass that law, which labeled Fordish as a child molester, despite court rulings to the contrary, I did my very best to get those members to say what they were saying on the floor when we were on interviews on television. And I would constantly say, why don't you say what you said on the floor? Or why don't you explain why you passed this law? And you could almost hear these staffers in the background going, no, no. And they would refuse to repeat what they said on the floor because they knew if they said it on Good Morning shows or television, they would not have immunity.
Right.
Schiff does a lot of interviews, and so he may not have legislative immunity. It depends where he was when he said it.
One more, because I'm fascinated by this, before we go back to your crystal ball. Look, I'm a member of the media, and I want there to be some more accountability on people that say things recklessly. I want us to have a fidelity to the truth, and we can't go around slandering individuals like Nick Salmon or Kyle Rittenhouse or John Paul Mac Isaac. I understand why you brought up the public figure, and for anyone listening, if you're a public figure, usually the standard, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Jonathan, is actual malice. You have to show that the person slandering you committed actual malice, meaning probably knew the truth, disregarded it, and didn't care. In fact, might have intended to sully your reputation. But I have a problem with the idea that John Paul Mac Isaac would be a public figure, because they're the ones, I think, that made him a public figure, not him. So, I mean, he finds a laptop, they report on it, now he's a public figure. They're the ones responsible. They can't be in charge of elevating their own standard of slander.
Yeah, that's part of the problem with this public figure standard. I teach torts, and I often talk to the students about whether we really have justification for a public figure standard. Justice Thomas and another one of his colleagues have raised recently whether we should reexamine what's called New York Times versus Sullivan, where the standard came from, when it applies to public figures. Because what they're saying is that we get it with regard to public officials, people who are in office. But why should you be forced to have a higher burden just because you were successful in business or sports or some other field? The courts, however, treat any effort on your part to contact, speak to the media as tripping this wire. That happened to Eric Fordish. He didn't say anything to the media until he's walking out of the courtroom one day and a reporter came up and said, hey, let me ask you a question. He turned around and answered it. And the court said, OK, you're now a public figure.
Wow.
These courts look for any tripwire interview.
Now, that explains why a lot of people won't give interviews, stay silent, even on courthouse steps. Okay, back to your crystal ball. So I want to go back to the Supreme Court and the fallout within the hall, within the chamber, within the building, and within the process. So I think it's fair to say, I think you would agree, that for the better part of approaching 50 years, Roe v. Wade and abortion has been the litmus test for confirmation for Supreme Court justices. It has lurked in the background of every single confirmation process over the last 50 years. What do you think happens now? I mean, all of a sudden, do we have a more pure process, or does this continue to be the way, the primary way that we vet justices for the Supreme Court? How would you vote on abortion?
Well, Will, I'm going to treat your question as just the fun of a hypothetical, because no one has ever suggested Congress would get more pure on any subject.
That's true. That's true.
I think that what we're going to see is it's probably going to get worse because now you're going to want a nominee that pledges to reverse the reversal of Roe. It's gotten very raw. I wrote a couple of columns during the Barrett confirmation process saying that we had gotten to a very dangerous point with Barrett, where Democratic senators demanded that she confirm how she would vote on Roe and also a pending Obamacare case. And they kept pressing her and saying they wouldn't accept anything but confirmation. And that's making a confirmation dependent upon a guarantee. That's something you're not supposed to do. And the weird thing about this is that nominees have never really given that assurance. I wrote a column yesterday responding to Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, saying that the Republican nominees had committed perjury in their confirmation hearings. And I noted that was just utter nonsense, that all of these nominees really give this rote response, simply saying Roe is established precedent and deserves respect. That's saying the obvious. That's like saying that the Supreme Court building's located in Washington. And there was no guarantee how they would vote. Funny enough, the most open and honest of any nominee in my lifetime was Justice Barrett. She was wonderfully clear. You know, she told the Senate, I don't consider Roe v. Wade to be so-called super precedent. I don't consider it to be inviolate. And, you know, I have raised questions in the past. In comparison to all of the people that came before her, that was a shocker for the many of us who watch these hearings or have to watch them.
So you're right. The left, many Democratic politicians are saying that these justices, from Kavanaugh and Gorsuch to Barrett, have lied. They have lied to the Senate confirmation process by saying what you just said, that they recognize Roe v. Wade as holding precedent. What you're saying is you think, and let's put it into plain speak, you think these justices at that time, would-be justices, threaded the needle. In other words, you're right. Saying that I respect precedent is like saying the Supreme Court's building sits in Washington, D.C. Every justice should respect precedent, but it's not a Ten Commandment. It's not one of our Ten Commandments. It's an instinct, precedent is. And the instinct
none of these justices said that they would never reverse Roe. They, you know, Plessy v. Ferguson was established.
But you think that the senators heard that. So when the would-be justices said, I recognize Roe v. Wade as precedent, the senators heard, okay, then you're promising not to overturn Roe v. Wade.
Well, the senators often hear what they want to hear. Senator Collins was recently quite upset, saying that she was misled. But that's a little bit odd, because many of these same senators, including Senator Schumer, went on the floor and said they're going to overturn Roe. So this is all rather bizarre revision of history. All of these justices gave fairly similar responses to Roe. Plessy v. Ferguson was established precedent for 58 years, and then it was overturned.
Right.
None of them promised that they would never overturn Roe, that they would never change their minds. They didn't even say what their minds were on Roe.
Right. And I've said this before. I think it's worth reiterating right here. Fidelity to precedent is an instinct. It's not a hard and fast, inviolable rule. And it's an instinct that comes secondary to getting the question right constitutionally. Clearly, that's what happened with Brown v. Board of Education. They recognized Plessy was wrong constitutionally, and any deference they gave it because it was settled law came secondary to the fact we need to get this right. We can't just be beholden to wrong law, no matter how long it's been, quote unquote, settled. Okay, two more things with you, Jonathan, looking forward. What happens now in your mind? Literally, what happens now? Assuming this draft opinion is published, what happens to abortion law in this country?
Well, as many of us have been saying, it's simply not true that this would make abortion unlawful in the United States. To the contrary, the majority of states already have laws that protect abortion, about 30 of them. It turns out that the vast majority of the population live in those states. We're not quite sure how many states would abolish or severely limit abortion, but it would become a test by a case, a state-by-state matter. In some ways, the critics of the opinion have got to get the narrative straight. You know, you have many of them saying, well, you know, this is the court frustrating or denying democracy because most people support the right to abortion. Well, if that's true, then nothing will change because states will then protect abortion. What I think you're likely to see is that a number of states are going to ban abortion or limit it the way Mississippi did to 15 weeks. It turns out that there's a lot of support for limiting abortion after 15 weeks.
Yeah, it's kind of odd to lament the fall of democracy when the question is being returned to the democratic process. Okay, final question. Many on the left, Jonathan, are saying this is just the beginning, that the Supreme Court will now hear Obergefell. They'll revisit gay marriage. They will revisit other cultural hot points that were decided at the Supreme Court. I want to ask you this, and I want to ask it, Jonathan, in a non-loaded manner, because I think there are others on the right who could say, well, this Supreme Court is one that is not willing to be trapped by precedent. If they feel like there are other decisions that their predecessors got wrong, they will revisit. So there are some that could look at this Supreme Court and go, are they willing to overturn other examples of precedent? And on the right, I don't think they'd be looking at gay marriage or whatever it may be. On the right, they might be identifying some cases they think it would be good to see a Supreme Court that is willing to overturn false precedent. And on the left, they're terrified that many of the big decisions that were decided in our culture, in our country, that weren't left to the democratic process could now be overturned at the Supreme Court. Do you think this Supreme Court will be aggressive in taking cases where they think precedent was wrong?
Yeah, I'm not convinced of that. The opinion itself says that this is confined in its application. Also, I think that knowing some of these justices, they would not likely sign off on some of these other areas. There's an effort to use this parade of horribles, including by President Biden, you know, in his statement yesterday that states may be segregating school children by their gender identity. I tweeted out immediately that I have no idea where that came from. But more importantly, I don't think it helps. I think that all of this effort to create parade of horribles are actually undermining the argument. There's good faith arguments to make about Roe v. Wade, about privacy. You don't have to have the parade of horribles. But I think that what you're seeing in the last couple of days is that people have gotten so careless about these examples that it can undermine their arguments, that people can begin to tune them out, sort of like the warnings on, you know, pharmaceutical products, that voice at the end that says, you know, monsterism might result. People sort of tune it out. And I think the Democrats are risking that. I mean, they've got a case to make here. It's a legitimate issue. It's divided us for many years. Make it. You don't have to suggest that we're going to be dividing children by gender identity or that the Supreme Court would ever allow that.
But just to press you on that for just one moment, I think you're right. Everything you just said, I agree with. I think for those on the left, they are parading out, as you said, this parade of horribles. But what I'm curious about is, and this is why I said I wanted to ask it in a non-loaded manner, I don't want to put a moral value on what happens next. I just want to know, will it happen next? In other words, I do think this is a watershed moment for the Supreme Court to revisit 50 years of precedent. I think, personally, they were right. I think it was weak constitutional and legal law. It was terribly stupid, Roe v. Wade and its constitutional analysis. But I also recognize that no Supreme Court through the 90s or the 2000s either had the votes or the willingness to revisit that precedent. And now all of a sudden, we have a Supreme Court with at least a 5-4 majority who has shown an instinct or a willingness to do what no one has done before, at least for the previous 50 years. And without using the parade of horribles or without bringing the right in and saying, here's our parade of hopefuls, I'm just wondering if this Supreme Court is one that feels emboldened to do things that have not been done before and revisit some decisions they dislike.
Well, I think that they are, these justices are what we often call first principle justices. You know, I testified in favor of the confirmation of now Justice Gorsuch. And I really liked one thing about him is that he was a first principles justice. He tended to go back to the principle itself and then work back towards the problem. And they do share that methodology, and it will take them to places that previous courts might not have gone. But having said that, things like banning interracial marriage is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah. That's absurd.
There's no reason to believe that that would happen. and you know, they're banning prophylactics and things of that kind.
Right.
Those were all cases that were not dependent on the exact analysis of Roe. There's no reason to believe that they would do that. But these are principles.
But they're not also, in your mind, willing to go back and revisit the Commerce Clause, which many of us would say is the biggest expansion of federal government power, which was decided in the 1930s.
Yeah, they may be willing to do that. I'm not.
Oh, wow. Really?
The fact is that these are people that are driven by principle. I've defended both the left and the right of the court. I disagree with a lot of their decisions. But these people really do try to get it right. They're not ideologues. They have a judicial philosophy. I may disagree with it. But they try to be consistent. And that's one of the reasons they vote together all the time. You know, in one hearing, I remember Senator Whitehouse pressed me on, how do you explain these five conservative justices always voting together? That's, you know, that's a lock. That's, you know, those are ideologues. And I asked him, I said, well, how about the four justices on the other side? I mean, they vote together. I mean, right. Everyone hates the justices on the side they disagree with. The fact is you want them to be consistent. You want them to have jurisprudential consistency, and they haven't.
Well, I think we backed into the answer to my question. If they truly did revisit the Commerce Clause, that would be absolutely ground shaking. But I like how you described these justices, and I think you're right. That's a good characterization. First principles justices. So let's go out with this. Tell me if I have it right. In your mind, would you say Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Barrett are first principle justices? Maybe Kavanaugh, and probably not Roberts, who seems to be more procedurally oriented than first principles. And then the three liberal justices are whatever is cool with the current thing.
Well, I think that with Roberts, he is the ultimate incrementalist and institutionalist. You know,
right.
He is someone who really does get sticker shock, and I disagree with him. I disagreed with him on the individual mandate under Obamacare.
Yes.
You know, he wrote an absolutely spectacular section on federalism and said this was clearly a violation of federalism and cannot stand. And then the next section, he sort of shrugged and said, unless you call it a tax, which nobody is, but I'm going to
invented that. Right.
Yeah. And it was like, what? I mean, but that's really the result of an incrementalist. You know, the best example I could give you of Chief Justice Roberts. So I remember one time I was there for one of the investitures of a justice, and Roberts and I were talking, and I was admiring. One of the things I admire most in this ceremonial room is this magnificent chandelier. And Roberts came up and he said, I'm so glad to see you taking such an interest in the chandelier. And he proceeded to give me every detail of how the chandelier was made, when it was made, and how he had to go to Czechoslovakia to find someone who could even clean it. And I remember thinking, this is a guy that identifies with every inch of this building. I mean, he has this just intense connection to the court. And I think it does affect his judgment. And he's not the first Chief Justice to have that incrementalist sort of attitude.
If that's the case, and I believe that your description of Roberts is probably accurate, no one is taking the news of this leaker harder than Roberts, because it undermines the thing that he seems to have the most fidelity to, and that's the integrity of the Supreme Court itself. Jonathan Turley, great to talk to you in long form. Thank you for this.
Thank you, Bill.
There you go. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jonathan Turley, as this continues to be one of the major news events, not just of the moment, but of the coming months, of the coming years, when it comes to elections and when it comes to the third branch of our government. This story will stay.
We'll be right back with more of the Will Cain Podcast.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle, a run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Story number three. In the spirit of my crushing sports losses yesterday, let's do my five worst losses as a sports fan. At number five, the Texas Longhorns. Now, the Texas Longhorns have given me plenty of opportunity for heartbreak. It seems like every year against OU and the Texas OU rivalry, there's a new way in which the Longhorns look to break your heart. This year in 2021, they choked up again what seemed like an insurmountable lead in the second half of that game as OU came back. And when we think about losses, I think there's two worst kinds of losses. One is when it's in your hands. You got it won. City had it won in the 89th minute. Texas had the Red River rivalry won in dominating fashion. You've got the meal in your mouth. You're in the process of swallowing. And then somebody punches you right in the stomach and you throw it all up. You choke. That is a devastating form of loss. The other devastating form of loss is when you lose a sense of stakes and expectation. Almost all of these losses you're about to hear are when the stakes are the highest. In 2010, the Texas Longhorns were in the national championship game against the Alabama Crimson Tide. Alabama was not yet the Alabama that you know. Nick Saban had not yet won a national championship with Alabama. But Texas had in 2005 with Vince Young. They were back. After some heartbreakers in the meantime, by the way, Texas had the infamous Michael Crabtree completion at the end of a game against Texas Tech in 2008. Texas, again, has had their fair shares of absolute devastating losses. But in 2010, Colt McCoy was on top of the world. And Texas, the expectation was there that they could win the national championship again. Think about how history diverges at this moment. If Texas wins a second national championship, it's on its way to an absolute dynastic reputation. Mack Brown never gets fired. They continue to pull in big recruits, and they perhaps stack up, if not national championships, top five finishes through the 2010s. Instead, Texas falls to the depths at which they are today, cycling through coach after coach, from Mack Brown to Charlie Strong to Tom Herman to Steve Sarkisian. It's so embarrassing that again, and that's the operative word here, again in 2022, not a single University of Texas player was drafted in the NFL draft. Texas, the state, led the NFL draft, I believe, with 32 players drafted and not a one from the University of Texas. On the other hand, this championship game launches on this divergent path Nick Saban and the Alabama Crimson Tide's dynasty that we know of today. I mean, but for Clemson, almost unbeatable. And Georgia, recently, almost unbeatable for more than a decade. What happened in this 2010 National Championship game was that Colt McCoy got hurt. He got his shoulder dislocated on a quarterback sneak early in the game. And then it was over. Everything changed. Yeah, we put in a freshman quarterback, and he did okay, as well as can be expected, but you have to play the what-if game. What would have happened? What if Colt never got hurt? Would this divergent path have happened? And I live with that alternate history today. At number four, the stakes are lower, but perhaps the heart investment even higher. It is the Dallas Cowboys, who also have given us so many opportunities for heartbreak. Can we talk about that for just one moment? Look, the Cowboys of the 70s would have been the team of the decade, but for the Pittsburgh Steelers. They lost two Super Bowls to the Pittsburgh Steelers. One of them, infamously, with a drop by tight end Jackie Smith in the end zone. But I wasn't alive, or if I was alive, I was a toddler, and so I didn't experience any of this. But I heard about it, and I watched old NFL films, and it's almost like I lived it. But I didn't live it. It was more just there, like anything, a part of my history. So I can't own those in the same way some of my older listeners might. The 1994 NFC Championship game was horrendous because Deion Sanders committed pass interference on Michael Irvin, which would have put Dallas on their way to their third straight Super Bowl and in probably 4 in 4 years, as they ended up winning 3 in 4 years. That one hurts again because 4 Super Bowls in a row, and I have no doubt they would have beat the Chargers if not for that game against the San Francisco 49ers. Tony Romo's botched snap in the wild card game against the Seattle Seahawks in 06. Stakes aren't as high. It hurt. I was at a bar with my mom and my wife in New York City at the time, Blondie's on the Upper West Side, and I had to live that out publicly. 2017, Aaron Rodgers hits Jared Cook on the most amazing play. It's a gut-wrencher, but Rodgers is amazing. He's a magic man. Some people have pointed out to me because I asked for the worst losses on Twitter. What about 85? Bears 44, Cowboys 0. Listen, again, there are levels to this. That kind of domination hurts. It's embarrassing, but it's not the kind that keeps you from going to bed. These keep you from going to bed. Number four, 2014. Dez caught it. The divisional round of the NFL playoffs, Dallas Cowboys against the Green Bay Packers. Go back and look at the clip. It's everywhere. Dez caught it. Dez caught the ball, scored a touchdown. This has led us down the path ever since, along with Calvin Johnson, infamously, of asking ourselves, what's a catch? The NFL still can't answer that. It's like asking, hey, define God. It's impossible. Define a catch. They can't. Still can't get it right. But if you look back at that game and you don't think that what Dez did was catch a ball there, then I can't help you. Not only do you not understand football, you don't understand reality. Now, I'm going to give Packers fans something here. There was a lot of time left on the clock, and it's Aaron Rodgers. And would they have marched back down and scored for the Packers to ultimately win the game? I can't say no. Obviously, I can't say no. But that one is an alternate history because it's a history that should have happened. Dez caught it. At number three, 2006 NBA Finals, Dallas Mavericks against the Miami Heat. Again, this is my list. Obviously, it's Dallas-centric. It doesn't matter if it's not in your heart. I don't care about Falcons, Patriots, 28-3. I don't care. These aren't my teams. That was fun to watch from a distance, but they didn't hurt me on the inside. This is what hurts me on the inside. Mavericks up 2-0 in the series, dominating in the third game, well into the third quarter. And that's when Dwayne Wade, or rather, Bennett Salvatore, took over. Who's Bennett Salvatore? Well, he's a proxy here, but the referees of the NBA. Blow on Dwayne Wade, foul. Dwayne Wade spent the entire series from then on out at the foul line. And just free throw after free throw, the Mavericks to death. Mavericks lost that NBA Finals. The only reason it's not higher is because in 2011, we exacted revenge by taking down Dwayne Wade and LeBron James in the Miami Heat. It's almost like that one is so sweet, you forget the bitterness of 06. And wouldn't have been so sweet but for the bitterness of 06. But I remember how 06 felt, and it hurt. At number two, because you have to elevate the stakes. In my lifetime, the Cowboys haven't lost a Super Bowl. They're 5-3 in Super Bowls, and those three losses were, again, before my time. Steelers and, I believe, Broncos off the top of my head. Colts. Colts. Bob Lilly game through his helmet. So in my lifetime, the stakes the Cowboys choked on the highest was the NFC Championship game. And it's my first real sports memory. I've told you about it before. 1981, San Francisco 49ers, Dallas Cowboys. All of these, when it comes to football, seem to be at the hands of the Green Bay Packers or the San Francisco 49ers. And we've returned the favor. It's been even. They've had their rough times, mostly with the 90s Cowboys, in this same set of rivalries. 1981, Ed Too Tall Jones is chasing down then a somewhat unheralded quarterback in Joe Montana, rolling out to his right, who throws a prayer over Too Tall, into the back of the end zone, and it's caught by Dwight Clark, who little six-year-old me spent the next 2 years arguing with every 49er fan I knew that he had stick-em on his hands. He cheated. Who pulled it down for the win over Everson Walls. I cried. I ran out of the room, 5-6 years old, whatever I was. Ran out of the room. Parents were having a party, watching party, viewing party. Went to the bathroom, cried. I got a son like that now, and I know where he got it. But at number one, the worst sports loss of my fandom has to be the 2011 World Series. The Texas Rangers against the St. Louis Cardinals, Game 6. The Rangers can clinch the World Series. Game 6 is the deciding game. The Rangers have already won 3. They're up 3-2. And they are one strike away from winning the World Series. Rangers, not a franchise cloaked in glory. Not one with trophies in the room. One strike away from winning the World Series. And they don't. Nelson Cruz drops a ball in the outfield. Natale Feliz can't get a strike. But here's the kicker. One strike away again in the following inning. The Cardinals scored, I believe it was in the eighth or ninth. I know it was enough that it was over if anybody won. The Cardinals got their run, tied the game when the Rangers couldn't get that strike to win the World Series. But the Rangers came back, and Josh Hamilton hit a home run. Now the Rangers are up again. Now when they're up on the mound in the following bottom of the 10th, let's say, then we're one strike away from winning again. Wasn't it David Freese? I think I'll always remember. Wasn't it David Freese? Got the hit, scored the run, scored the winning run. Cardinals win Game 6. Who cares about Game 7? It's so freaking deflating. Of course, the Rangers lost Game 7. Not unlike Manchester City. Once you give up two goals in 1 minute, you're going to lose in overtime. You don't believe in momentum? Become a sports fan. Momentum's real. I can't believe the sports nerds, the data nerds, who say momentum's not real. Have you ever watched a game from start to finish? Have you ever been emotionally invested in a game? Have you ever played a game? Momentum is real. The Rangers weren't going to win Game 7. And they didn't. And that's the championship that was the closest to being all the way down the gullet before the gut punch and choking and throwing it all up. I'm sure you have your list wherever you are, whatever you're a sports fan of. And I know those of you in Atlanta deserve special mention, as do those of you in Cleveland with the drive and the fumble. Every single one of you have your moments, have your list that you can't forget. You can hit me up on Twitter at Will Cain or Instagram C Will Cain and give me your list. Tell me your worst memories as a sports fan. For me, yesterday didn't make the top five. Man, it stunk. That does it for me today here on the Will Cain Podcast. I will see you again on Monday.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.